It did. It was originally just going to be a whole bunch of stories of funny things that had happened to me as a comedian. And so I started writing it in about 2003, before I was on TV, before Spicks and Specs. Took it to a whole bunch of publishers and they said, no one knows who you are yet. Wait till you get famous. So then, you know, I went off. I was on TV. And then last year, took it back to a publisher and said, look, I've written a book. And they said, no, you've written half a book. We want to hear about what happened after you got famous. So then I had to add more stories to it, but I realized as I did that there was this kind of ongoing narrative. The reason the book's called Best Foot Forward is because I'm still not entirely sure which one is my best foot. I was born without a right foot, so for years I didn't talk about it, focused on my comedy, and I thought I was putting my best foot forward. And then years later, when I finally started talking about having a prosthetic foot, it became a big focus of my act, and it got me even more attention, so maybe that's my best foot.
Well, you owe quite a lot to a man called Richard Jones, I believe.
I do indeed. Richard Jones was the first specialist that saw me after I was born. And he said all the other specialists and surgeons that were called in when I was literally minutes old suggested amputating below the knee because they didn't know what that thing was at the end of my right foot. And it turned out that thing at the end of my right foot was a tiny little ankle, a slightly deformed ankle, but an ankle nonetheless. And it meant that later in life, by keeping the ankle, which is what he thought it might have been, I can walk without the prosthetic, but I'm just shorter on one side than the other. And it's made my life a lot easier, I think. So I do see him every now and again, and I always thank him when I see him.
Your parents were told to treat you like a normal kid, so they enrolled you in gymnastics. I believe you were about 8.
I was indeed. I can do a cartwheel now if you'd like.
I would love you to.
Really?
Yes.
Okay. I'm actually going to do it in the studio here. I know no one at home is going to believe that I'm doing it.
No, but I believe you. We believe you. We're there.
Okay. No, I know you're believing me. Okay, I'm going to do this for people who are listening right now and thinking, oh, he's just going to do one of those comedy, oh, like make a noise and pretend he's doing a cartwheel. I am literally going to do a cartwheel in the studio. Okay, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to take my headphones off.
No, that's all right.
Here we go. Right. I'm in the far side of the studio for those of you. I'm emptying my pockets. I've made this mistake before. Never do a cartwheel. Oh, man, I'm going to actually hurt something in here. Okay, I'll be honest, it was half a cartwheel because I was worried I was going to break a light, but I did do it. How's that for award-winning radio?
I tell you what, it's possibly the best moment of my radio life. I'm not going to lie to you.
I may have pulled a muscle.
Well, that's right. You can sit down and make yourself comfy now because
I'm not sure I can sit down. Well, I can't tell you where the muscle is.
That's not a problem either because you are a stand-up comedian.
Absolutely.
What did your mum say, Adam Hills, when you told her that you wanted to be a stand-up comedian? Because clearly your gym career was, you know, it's good, but it wasn't going to get you there.
My mum's exact words were, but you're not funny. But I really think she's scarred. She's absolutely scarred. I just thought that would be a really funny way to start the book. You know, when I first told my mum I wanted to be a stand-up comic, she said, but you're not funny. And I think I've really upset her, and I have to keep reminding her that I'm fine with it. It all worked out. And I think she was just, I was at university at the time and I was studying to be a journalist, as it turns out. And I think she panicked and thought I was just going to quit university, throw it all away and follow stand-up comedy. So I think by saying, but you're not funny was, and then to be fair, I wasn't a particularly hilarious kid. I was very shy. I was very quiet. I was very studious. But when it was my turn to speak, I was quite happy to show off and try and be funny.
Were you, I read this in your book, you grew up like surrounded, like we all did, snakes and spiders. And when you were told to shake your shoes before you put them on in case the red bat drops out, you only had to shake the one shoe.
I know, but I still did both because I like to do what all the other kids did.
Yeah. Don't we all? See, you're just a little guy, just wanted to please his mum and prove to his mum he was funny, and this is what it all... It just always comes down to the same thing with you blokes, doesn't it?
It really does. But I think there's a thing about people with so-called disabilities, and I use the word so-called because, I don't know, I never really see myself as disabled, and most of the people that I know that class as disabled don't see themselves as disabled either, but we're very stubborn, and if you tell us we can't do something, then we'll do it. And if you, we just want to do what everybody else does. So for me, shaking out both shoes and making sure there wasn't a spider in both shoes was what all the kids did. And, you know, I think I even point out in the book, if I had put my right shoe on with a solid rubber prosthetic, any spider in there would have been squished. So in many senses, I was doing it for the spider's benefit, not mine.
Free the spiders. Now, can we talk about your radio career?
Yeah.
The man who came on your radio show to talk about the Macarena.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and how long did he pretend he couldn't speak English?
I mean, it was a good minute. It was a good minute of this man sitting there. And to be fair, he came in last minute, so we didn't have a chance to talk to him beforehand. And he sat opposite and we were, hey, we're live on air. Hey, you must be really happy with the Macarena. And he just said nothing. And then we kind of went, so tell us more about the tour. And nothing. And then he looked at the publicist and said something in Spanish. And she said, oh, I'm so sorry. I should have told you. He doesn't speak English. And we're like on air just going, well, why bring him in? What kind of conversation are we going to have? And I was just about, I started making fun of him, thinking, well, he doesn't know what I'm saying. And I was just about to rip into him when I went, hang on, I read your biography last night. It said that you're fluent in three languages, including English. And he went, oh, man, you're the first person to read the biog. And it turned out this was a practical joke they played on every radio announcer. He would pretend he didn't speak English for a good, like, 2 or 3 minutes of the interview. And I was the first person to have caught him out.
Now you move from radio where it was, you're clearly very at home, and then you move into television, and you learn everything you know about hosting a television show from a man called Peter Feynman.
Yes, yeah. Can I point out, I was not at home on radio. I loved it, but I was not the best radio announcer.
I was just trying to make you feel better about yourself.
There was one morning where I literally, at 6 o'clock in the morning, I got a CD ready. I think it was Alanis Morissette. I put it into the CD player. I checked it. I turned the microphone on. I introduced it, but I was so tired. For some reason, I took the CD out and put it back away again, introduced it, then pushed play and couldn't work out why the CD wasn't playing. And then spent a minute fumbling around trying to find it, found the case, put it back in, pressed play again, sat back in my chair, swore very loudly at myself, and then realised my microphone was still on. So none of that was ever going to make a radio career.
No, that is radio gold, because the listeners in my vast experience love it.
There were no complaints, to be fair. There were no complaints.
That's like the best moment of the day. They can say, did you hear that bloke Adam Hills on the radio?
And you're right, the person who taught me about TV was a guy called Peter Feynman. He directed Graham Kennedy, Don Lane, The Paul Hogan Show. He directed Crocodile Dundee. And he was brought on to teach me how to be a TV host when I started hosting Spicks and Specs on the ABC. And the best advice he ever gave me was, he said, you have to treat the TV show as if it's a dinner party. And all the people on the panel are guests, and the camera is a guest who has just arrived and doesn't know who anybody else is or who you're talking about. So you have to introduce all the guests to the camera. You have to introduce the topics. And if someone comes up that they're talking about that you think the camera doesn't know about, then you have to explain it to them. And that was just the perfect way of describing to me how to host a TV show.
This is Adam Hills. His book is Best Foot Forward. It's a memoir, and we're talking about it. It's a very good memoir. I'm jumping around a little bit. I'm Jill O'Shaughnessy. You're listening to ABC Radio Perth. A little bit like that.
Why are you jumping around a little bit?
I'm jumping around a little. Oh, no, I'm not literally jumping.
I thought you meant physically.
Just because you're all about doing cartwheels on live radio, I'm much more about strolling. I have my phone in my pants.
I beg your pardon.
I've got my phone in my pants because I don't want to fork out a lot of money for one of those step things, but I feel like I need to up my step count.
Right.
Day. So my phone is in my trousers because, and I'm walking around.
Oh, I see. So you're not actually, here's what I think you're doing.
Yes.
You're not actually upping your step count. You're just making sure your phone is with you for every single step you take during the day, regardless of how short the walk is. Am I right?
It counts them.
No, I know what you mean. You kind of get to the end of the day and you go, oh, man, have I only done that many steps?
Yes.
And then you think, oh, hang on, I didn't have my phone in my pocket when I went upstairs to the bathroom.
Exactly.
That was a good, like, 35 steps.
Yes.
Yeah, no, yeah, okay. So I like that. You're not increasing your steps. You're just making sure you count all of them.
Yes. You don't want to waste. I mean, I'm not sure a man that, you know, only has one foot would really understand the complexities involved in the steps. Does your phone, your step counter, count both feet?
Oh, my God, I hope not. And the reason I say I hope not, because if it doesn't, that means I've been doing double the amount of steps that I think I have. And so my step count is probably up to par. I'm going to use that as an excuse from now on. Every time I look at my phone, I'll go, yeah, but it only counts one step out of the two.
You are welcome, Adam Mills.
Thank you.
Can we talk about Billy Connolly? Because
he has made,
through your memoir, Best Foot Forward, he's made quite a few appearances.
He kind of became like my hairy godmother in that he kept popping up throughout my career to give me, accidentally, I bumped into him the first time I was 19. I was outside the Sydney Opera House and he was just there to do a show and I met him on the street and had a bit of a chat and he was really lovely. And then when I was in radio about 10 years later, I got to take some people backstage to meet him and he was all very polite. Until he found out I was a stand-up comedian. And then he was like, oh, my God. Oh, did you like my show? Oh, just do it. You'll love it. It's the best job in the world. You'll hate it, but you'll love it. And he walked up down the hallway pumping his fist at me going, just do it. You'll love it. And not long after that, I had to make a choice between radio and stand-up comedy. And I remember this little voice on my shoulder going, just do it. Just do it. And so that was instrumental in me deciding that I was going to follow my dream of being a stand-up comic. And then about 5 years later, I was at the London Comedy Store and I was the last act on and it just happened to be the one night that Billy Connolly popped in to watch the show. So I told the whole story on stage and said, Billy, I'm so grateful. You're the reason I'm here. And he came backstage afterwards, burst through the door and went, you did it! I'm so proud of you! And so he's just... There's a really lovely, excuse me, epilogue to the book where I know Kathy Lett, the author, is a friend of his, so I sent her an email to pass on to him just to say thank you for appearing throughout my life. And he wrote this lovely little email back, and it's just accidentally he's been, like I said, my hairy godmother throughout my career.
It says, Dear Adam, how nice to hear from you. Your success in Britain makes me very happy. It couldn't happen to a nicer guy. I love your Aussie. It's spelled like Aussie ostrich, just for listeners' information. I love your Aussie optimism. Good luck to you, Billy Connolly. Kiss, kiss, kiss. That is a pretty special note.
I mean, I'm going to dine out on that forever. But the funny thing was, the reason I sent him the email was that I'd been asked to do an interview about him for a TV show about his life, which I did, and I turned up for the interview and they said, we want you to tell the story of when you met Billy at the Comedy Store in Adelaide. Mm. And I said, oh, that's interesting. How do you know about that story? And they said, we interviewed Billy last week and he told us about it. And I went, what do you mean he told you about it? And they said, well, we were talking about, you know, comedians that he's influenced and he apparently said, oh, I met Adam Hills once. So I thought, this is amazing. Billy Connolly's talking about the time he met me in an interview. So he's just such a lovely guy. And I really, really, really hope I get to meet him in the next couple of years because I just want to sit down and have a cup of tea with him.
Oh, don't you just love... And don't you love it when people like that are wonderful?
You know what? I found... I mean, I would imagine almost every comedian has a Billy Connolly story because he seems to be like that with everyone. But I have noticed that a lot of comedians, not all, but a lot of comedians are very helpful. And I think, I genuinely think it, because it's such a, what's the word? There's an intangible thing about comedy. You don't get a university degree. You don't have proof that you're good at what you do, which means it could all fall apart at any minute. It's quite a humbling profession because you never know from one second to the next whether you're still going to be funny. So I think because of that, we all know how fragile it is that we have a career in the first place. So I think most comedians are quite friendly and helpful to other comedians because we're all in the same boat.
Adam Hills is our guest on ABC Radio Perth. I'm Jill O'Shaughnessy. His memoir is Best Foot Forward. Now, you, which we've talked about, you didn't think of yourself as disabled. You didn't like the term disabled, but you did come to work in, you were asked to host the 2008 Beijing Paralympic Games. You've done a lot of work around this area and your perspective has really changed.
Yeah, I think the big eye-opener for me was, I mean, when I was a kid, I was asked to try out for the disabled games or the Paralympics, and I was disabled, and for a number of reasons, partly through defiance and partly through that thing of going, no, I'm like everybody else, but also because I was only missing a little bit of my right foot, and I thought it would be unfair to go and compete against people who were missing, you know, two legs. Little did I realise there are different categories, and I wouldn't have been doing that. So, but it wasn't really until I got to Beijing and hung out with a whole bunch of Paralympians and watched them compete that I realised that they don't consider themselves to be disabled either, really. When you see someone with one arm or with one leg doing the high jump or swimming 100 metres, it's almost the only place in the world where they don't feel disabled, if that makes any sense. And I've come to realise that recently because I've started playing disability rugby league in England. And in fact, the reason I'm in Australia at the moment is because I brought out the Warrington Wolves disability rugby league team for whom I play, and we played a game against the South Sydney Rabbitohs disability rugby league team at ANZ Stadium last week. And we've all felt a similar thing, that when we're on the field playing, it's the one time we don't feel disabled. It's the one time we don't feel like there's anything missing, because I can walk down the street in a pair of shorts in London and everyone will look at my prosthetic. But when I run onto the rugby field with people who've got one arm or one leg or cerebral palsy or vision impairment or whatever else, no one looks at my leg. That's the one place where it's like a level playing field. So I guess the eye-opener for me was realising that Paralympians don't see themselves as being disabled, and that's... yeah, that's what turned a lot of it around for me.
And Jason Helwig, the chef de mission, talks to you and says they're not brave and they're not inspired.
No, that was the first thing I was told at the Beijing Paralympics. And every journalist should be told this when they're covering Paralympic sport. Every journalist should be told this. This isn't disabled sport. This is elite athletes. These are elite athletes who have trained their backsides off for 4 years to be here. And when you see it as elite sport, then the disabilities just fall away. And I really think there's a thing. Everyone has the same thing at the Paralympics. You turn up, and even once you've been told that, you watch and you go, oh, there's a guy in a wheelchair. Oh, there's a guy with one leg. Oh, I see what they're doing. And after about 3 days, you ignore all of that and you go, oh, man, that's a really fast swimmer. Oh, that's really amazing basketball. Wow, that guy just jumped like 3 metres or whatever. And, yeah, when you look at – and I also get that now playing rugby league, because the Paralympics were invented by Dr. Ludwig Guttmann in Stoke Mandeville, I think, in 1948, if I'm not mistaken. I might be wrong with that, at the end of World War II. And the reason he invented it was because there are a lot of injured war veterans in wheelchairs. And he didn't invent it for their physical well-being. He invented it for their mental well-being, because some kind of sport, something to aim at, I think they started with archery, is so good for, you know, your mood and your attitude. And what I've found playing disability rugby league, what we've all found, is that all of us are happier, all of us are healthier, and all of us have a different attitude. So what I've realised through all of this is the power that sport has to change people's lives, really.
It is a beautiful thing that comes across in the book. I love the book. It's very funny. There's some great stories. I'm very jealous you met Kermit.
Which, I mean, honestly, I say it in the book, but I really mean it. The two men who have meant the most to me recently are Kermit the Frog and the Dalai Lama.
Oh.
And I'm not sure which is the more enlightened of the two.
We have to say goodbye.
Oh, what a note to leave it on. Read the book. You'll find out more.